fighting for America.
These are people that are here illegally, get caught, get convicted, and you release back out in the public. And the president promised the American people he would deport them, and he's not.
Fighting for Idaho.
A man came to the house as she was leaving Saturday night asking about the wooden pallets that Akery and Evans sold. Police say when she got back home, Evans had been shot to death.
Fighting for you.
You're walking around with high heels on in a size 14 and a big Adam's apple. Come on, people are going to look at you weird. You could go out the door dressed a little more normal so you don't attract all that attention, but clearly you want to.
Boise's Mr. Right, Kevin Miller in the Morning, winner of the 2014 Marconi Radio Award on 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
580 KIDO, Kevin Miller in the Morning, our great friend Jonathan Wohlstetter with us from letterfromthecapitol.com. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Kevin.
You know,
to be with you and your audience.
Good to have you with us. Great to, you know, I'm looking at letterfromthecapitol.com, and for those in the East, they wonder, you know, about global warming. Of course, in the West, the winter's been pretty mild.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, I'm having a little fun when I post those particular things, because way back when this global warming became a big issue in the late 80s, and I think it was in the very hot summer of 1988 that NASA's James Hansen testified with wildly inaccurate models, climate models. Much was made of hot days that summer and going on. Every time there was a day over 100 degrees somewhere, we'd have some newscast to remind us of climate warming. And now, of course, when record cold temperatures have surfaced in the last decade or so, all of a sudden we're told weather is not climate. And that's true. A day, you know, even the sliver that the global warmists use, particularly the warming period that took place starting in 1940, in 1970s and 80s, and, you know, a few other slivers are nanoseconds in geologic time. But rapid shifts have occurred in climate within less than a century, as happened in the 14th and 19th centuries. So I just have a little fun every now and then with the climate warmest types by just posting some of the cold weather news. And the truth is that we know a lot less. I think the truth is we know a lot less than the scientists would have us believe, and many of those who would say as much have been shamed, intimidated into silence. There have been some people who protested what is a form of McCarthyism. So when I do a posting of this kind, I'm just having a little fun at the expense of the climate warmest types. They hate to see posts of this kind. So, but we did see here, what I did show here is that this was that 40 years ago, and I remember this in my young adulthood, they were talking about a new ice age. There was articles in Time and Newsweek, and again with Walter Cronkite. For the younger members of the audience, and now considering that Cronkite left the air, oh, I think it was in 1981 or something, I think he ceded to Dan Rather, it is just hard to explain how trusted he was, because there's no one close to Cronkite's stature, but he really was the most trusted man in America, and his turning was a factor in causing an American president to decide not to run again for elective office.
Right, and the progressives hail Walter Cronkite as their hero for not reporting the news, but for becoming part of the news and making news.
Well, you know, I'll say this for Cronkite. Look, it's true that we look at what he did now, and it's true that he did more and more as life went on. He became more pronounced in that. But the truth is that he was expressing what was considered to be a broad societal consensus at the time. Remember that Goldwaterism, in Goldwater appeared to, and conservatism appeared to have suffered a crushing defeat in 1964, repudiation that was expected to last forever, and it turned out Ronald Reagan prove that not to be correct, but at the time that Cronkite was saying things like this, while it's true that Richard Nixon could win a narrow majority, it's also true that many of the intellectual classes, there was virtually no disagreement. And it really, there were a few people, voices in the wilderness like William Buckley and others. And in government, you had a virtual monopoly of big government types. It was really in the late 70s and 80s that the conservative movement was invigorated by think tanks and by funding. And now you have a whole, a large army, so to speak, of conservative thinkers who are publishing on things and people who are serving in government during conservative administrations. But at the time, Cronkite literally was thought almost as the voice of the deity, and he really was the voice of the space program, I have to say. It was like Jim McKay of ABC with the Olympics for several decades. It almost didn't seem to be an official event unless they were part of it.
Well, we've come a long way, Jonathan Wolstetter, from Walter Cronkite to Brian Williams.
Well, I think that Cronkite would be far less likely to do something like that. And I also think that there was at least in that generation, there was a commitment to try and report the facts, and then you could put the cast on it that you liked in at least two programs. And I remember this very well. Eric Severide of CBS and Howard K. Smith, who was an anchor at ABC, both of whom cut their teeth in World War II, they would say, that's tonight's news and a comment, in the case of Howard K. Smith. And in the case of Severide, when he gave his commentary, it was labeled explicitly on the screen as commentary. So they tried, at least in their reporting, and of course, it's impossible to fully do so to eliminate tendencies, because the very selection of stories that you make is an editorial choice. And you could tell that by just looking at the stories that Fox carries compared to the stories that MSNBC carries. And what's news and what isn't.
Well, and then we have, when it comes to popular culture, then we have entertainment being used for not entertaining, but indoctrination, where it becomes cultural issues, or the Republicans are bad. I mean, I'm watching dramas, comedies, sitcoms, and everything, and in all of them, Republicans are bad. That has to have an impact on impressionable young people that may or may not have the critical thinking skills to go, it's just all entertainment.
Well, the first, I think, example of overt proselytizing, I mean, they were always, even growing up watching the sitcoms, but then it was what America basically stood for then, the nuclear family and all that. It wasn't explicitly political, but then you had Norman Lear with All in the Family, Archie Bunker in 1971, and that inaugurated explicitly this inculcation of these values. And, of course, the entertainment community has always been, at least in some respects, separated from the larger community in the way they've been able to live. This is the people who were not living fully ordinary lives, but at the same time, way back when, they did stand for values that largely were the values that their fellow Americans stood for. And now you have a Hollywood that is, I think, monumentally self-absorbed. And so they can refuse to honor, except for one award of a sound recording or something, they don't honor a film, American Sniper, which has now made $500 million worldwide, I think over $300 million just stateside. It's the top grossing film, and it was, very well made. But you could see this start also in the 70s in the Academy Awards, when they got very explicitly political. One year, Marlon Brando sent an Indian squaw up to accept his award. And then, of course, at the time of the fall of Vietnam, some producers literally got up in getting an award and congratulated the Vietnamese on their victory, the North Vietnamese. So things did get very explicitly political, and you know, these are people who are wealthy enough that they don't have to make successful films all the time. The actors and actresses get paid anyway, and those who are in the top tier get paid, obviously, immense sums of money. But it seems as if even those producing them turn down chances to make more popular films, and they want to make their political statements.
Right. It would be nice to get back to films that actually promote America, promote American values. Were you surprised at how American Sniper came under attack, where you had people saying that snipers aren't heroes?
Well, I wasn't surprised because we've seen already all sorts of things. There are comments. There are a lot of people out there who think like Michael Moore. And they don't understand, in some cases, of course, in the case with snipers, people don't understand that snipers themselves are targets. And they don't understand, and hopefully more do now after seeing the film, the very vital role they play changing combat situations. But also what came out in the film, which I think was a very important theme, was this idea of he was living in two worlds. And this is the difficulty a lot of combat veterans have. They come back. Somebody put it in an article last week that I didn't post, but I read. They come back from there, and somebody's complaining about, damn, you know, we were on the train for 15 minutes today. As a result, I missed my appointment. And it was disastrous. This was a customer that I had planned to sell X, Y, and Z to, or my boss screamed at me, or this dopey computer won't work today. And, of course, compared to the problems that returning vets have, this is not likely to impress somebody who has had far more serious problems or seen his friends and seen his friends have more serious problems as well.
Jonathan Wohlstetter with us, letterfromthecapitol.com. If you want to keep informed of what's really going on, you want to make sure that you're ready to handle all the progressives, letterfromthecapitol.com. And coming up, we're going to take a look at a few other stories that you've covered and what's the latest in the Middle East. Jonathan, why don't you stand by, and we'll get back to you in 2 seconds. Do want to remind you that if you miss any part of the program, you can always go to 580KIDO.com, on Twitter at 580KIDO. And by the way, you can give me a follow at Kevin Miller Show, where we make sure that we tweet out the podcasts of interviews with great folks like Jonathan Wohlstetter each and every day. So if you miss a show, you can always go to the podcasts, and they're sleek, they're streamlined, and they're good to go. Plus our blogs. And the reason why we do this, we want to make sure that, well, you get what you come here for. You know, we'd love to be on all the time, but we can't be. So you can always check us out at 580KIDO.com. You're listening to Kevin Miller at 580KIDO. Let's get
Glenn Beck, weekdays at 9. Now back to Kevin Miller on 580KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
Kevin Miller in the morning, our great friend Jonathan Wohlstetter with us, letterfromthecapitol.com for more information from Jonathan. So it's been a few weeks since Netanyahu was in town. You've covered this situation from the very beginning. Were you surprised at the vitriol aimed at Benjamin Netanyahu, perhaps the most loyalist ally we've ever had?
I was somewhat. I've reached a point with this administration where little would truly surprise me. What was surprised me about it, really, was the sheer, I mean, that it was vicious and nasty did not surprise me, but that they were so stupid did. All it did was call much more attention to Netanyahu's speech. Britt Hume put it perfectly when they first started to complain about this. And they had been given 1 hour notice, by the way, which it doesn't sound like much, but Netanyahu was given 60 minutes less notice when Obama changed our position on the borders of a final Palestinian state while Netanyahu was in an airplane flying over the Atlantic. But what Britt Hume said, if I recall, I think he said this when he was on Megyn Kelly, he said, what this called for, or maybe it was with Brett Baer, what this call for was the president should have put his big boy britches on, and he should have invited Netanyahu for a brief meeting in the White House. It didn't have to be a summit or anything. Yeah, had him there and said, welcome to America, and enjoy your time speaking to the Congress. Instead, this incredibly boorish display, and I have never seen any leader treated so openly and contemptuously. And none of our adversaries, I guarantee you, if the Iranians ever came to Washington, they'd be treated with a lot of respect. This is one of our very best allies, and I think it's inflicting damage on the relationship, because although the Israelis, I think, probably understand that Americans as a whole feel very well disposed towards Israel, they realize that a president who has been, in many respects, though not all, has been anti-Israel, I would argue that where he's been supportive, it's because the American military needs Israel's cooperation in a lot of things, which they do. That America can not only elect someone like this, but can re-elect that person. And they didn't re-elect it on the issue of Israel. But if you're an Israeli and you're looking at America and how much can we count on the American guarantee, you're going to know that sometimes elections turn on domestic issues. And the president, the only thing he did in foreign policy when he was running the first time he tacked his position on Iran to Iran cannot be allowed to have a nuclear weapon, which is his declaratory, although not his real position, I would argue. And he did that because he knew that Americans wanted to hear something like that. But by other lights, the Israelis can look at this and say, listen, domestic factors, as they could, for example, determine the Israeli election taking place a week from today, domestic factors could dictate it. And if that's the case, America could elect an anti-Israel president. They did with Jimmy Carter also, but in that case, Carter only served one term. They could even re-elect somebody because they're focusing on other issues. And that's more consolation to Israel. It has to deal with Obama for another 2 years. He's now hugely unpopular over there in Israel.
Right, and it just seemed as if the world has gone topsy-turvy because the administration was overly sensitive to the Iranians who hate us, who have never been trusted, call us the great Satan, want to annihilate us, want another holocaust of the Israelis, the Jewish people, and the president and his crew are treating them as if they're the Israelis and the Israelis like they're the Iranians.
Well, this is a perversity that affects a large share of America's foreign policy establishment. To be fair, it includes a bunch of Republicans as well, although more Democrats. And, you know, when you're talking carrots and sticks and you're dealing with bad people, we tend to negotiate with bad people the same way at times we negotiate with good people, which is we assume that goodwill gestures will be reciprocated. And if that assumption gets strong enough when you're negotiating with bad people, you then lean on your allies to make similar concessions as well. When you negotiate with bad people, if you are in a position to force the outcome, which I think we were here, by ratcheting the sanctions up instead of softening them, you do so. You put a gun to their head. Now, we couldn't do that in the Cold War with the former Soviet Union because we didn't have that kind of leverage. The Soviet Union was a superpower, and we had to negotiate with them because democratic publics insist on it, even when it wasn't promising. But in that case, you have to negotiate bearing in mind you have an adversary you can't trust. As Ronald Reagan said, trust but verify, which he used to quote in the Russian, Dovryai no proviai. Now here, you've got an enemy who has never honored an agreement and has rarely done anything except under extreme pressure. When the hostages were released, the main reason the hostages were released, I think arguably, was that the Iranian regime decided they were no longer useful, they were more trouble than they were worth, and he was embroiled in a war that Saddam Hussein had started with the Ayatollah Khomeini's regime in September of 1980. So the hostages were released almost to the day, 4 months after that war was started, because they were in a desperate struggle against a mortal adversary, and they couldn't have distractions. And they didn't need the Americans possibly coming in and helping the Iraqis. So that's how, I mean, when you have someone like Mikhail Gorbachev, with whom we negotiated, Ronald Reagan negotiated, and Margaret Thatcher at the end of the last phase of the Cold War in the mid-'80s, in late-'80s, or when you have someone like Anwar Sadat, who kicked the Soviets out of Egypt in 1972, and then after recovering national pride in the Yom Kippur War in 73, he negotiated with the Israelis. You can negotiate with them. But look what Sadat did. Sadat went in 1977 to Jerusalem. You know, what was behind that was in part that he was scared that Jimmy Carter was going to have a conference in Geneva and invite all the terrorist parties to participate as well. And he preempted that by going to Jerusalem in November of 1977. But that one gesture made possible the Camp David peace accords, because it made clear that he was not like his predecessors. And when Gorbachev started the policies of, particularly of glasnost, openness, and allowing some public dissent, he clearly was a different leader than any of his predecessors. And of course, he did let Eastern Europe go in 1989. I remember one of the spokesmen, I think it was Gennady Gerasimov, was one of the regular spokesmen in the 1980s for the Russians. He called it the Frank Sinatra Doctrine, my way. And but when you had someone who was doing that, you were clearly dealing with a different kind of leader. But until you have a Gorbachev or a Sadat, which you certainly don't have in Iran now, and you don't have with the Palestinians either, and until then, you deal with them very differently. And instead, Obama projects that goodwill gestures will be accepted and rewarded rather than as they are being scorned.
More coming up with our great friend Jonathan Wolstetter next. You're listening to Kevin Miller, 580 KIDO.
Dave Ramsey, weekdays at noon. Now back to Kevin Miller on 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
580 KIDO, Jonathan Wolstetter with us as we continue on here at 580 KIDO. Remember, you can always reach us at 580KIDO.com and on Twitter. Jonathan, if people want to get a hold of you on social media, how can they get a hold of you? I know about your blog, Letter from the Capitol. Letterfromthecapitol.com.
Well, at the blog, you can go to my Twitter page from there and follow me on Twitter. That's one way that another way you can engage with me. Letter from the Capitol, O-L, spelled O-L at the end there, is a one-stop shop for my stuff. You can buy my books through Amazon or Barnes & Noble online. You can link to my articles in various publications, to past blogs. And, of course, as I said, you can follow on Twitter. I do. I've gotten in the habit of tweeting several times a day. It's almost as if I could borrow the formulation of the famous French philosopher René Descartes, who said in the 17th century, speaking in the Latin, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. It seems almost as if in the online age, people find themselves thinking, I tweet, therefore I am.
Speaking of Twitter, were you surprised that ISIS now is going after Twitter?
Not at all. The Internet is a fabulous recruiting tool for the Islamists. And the first one to see this, by the way, was the New York Police Department under Ray Kelly, which in August of 2007 issued a report on self-radicalization, the four stages of it. And I covered that actually in my first book, The Long War Ahead and the Short War Upon Us, because that came out months before I went to press. It's very important because it's a very efficient way of reaching large numbers of people. And in a way, we shouldn't be thinking of these people who are radicalized that way as lone wolves. If they're in extensive communication with these Islamist Islamist sites, and they're thereby in communication with Islamists who are working for these organizations, they're developing a relationship, and why should they be thought as being independent? I think that very clearly they get guidance, and they bring them in that way, and it's a very disturbing development, but one that we're going to be seeing for a long time.
Well, let's move on to ISIS and the administration, you know, still trying to figure out what the policy is. The only thing that we seem to know is that ISIS is getting stronger, and we had that 60 Minutes profile of the Iraqi leadership, but in reality, ISIS is still there, and we haven't really done anything cohesively to stop them.
Well, it's the old thing about power abhors a vacuum, and the thing is the president, in pulling back, he seemed to think that relatively benign forces would move in, and such is tragically not the case. His engagement with ISIS is very desultory. We're using less than 5% of our combat air power, for example, in this. And ISIS, which once was junior varsity, is now very much varsity, as we can see. And bear in mind, as far as their growing strength, what Osama bin Laden said. He said, people prefer a strong horse to a weak horse. He came after America, not because America, not, well, partly because we did go into Saudi Arabia and be occupied what he saw as a holy land, and we occupied it. But he also went after us in part because he saw America mostly in retreat. We didn't finish off Saddam in that war. After the Black Hawk Down mess in Somalia in 1993, having taken 18 dead and 75 wounded, we retreated. We retreated from Vietnam, of course, with much higher casualties. He saw a long list of retreats, and they said in communications from various people, including Zawahiri, number two, Ayman al-Zawahiri, said Americans abandoned their agents. So they saw a weak horse, and they miscalculated on 9/11. We weren't as weak as they thought. And this is the single thing that is the best way to discourage membership in ISIS, is to inflict defeats on them. You can imagine a recruiter coming into a madrasa or into a cafe and saying one of two things. Last night we gave the Americans a good kicking and their allies, and we advanced another 20 miles. Who wants to join up on our march to victory versus the same one coming in and saying, listen, we really need your help. Last night the Americas pushed us back 20 miles, Americans and their allies, and they inflicted very large casualties on our force. Where are they more likely to get recruits? Everybody likes to jump on the bandwagon of a winner. Nobody jumps on the bandwagon of a loser.
Jonathan Wolstetter with us, 580KIDO. But, you know, culturally, do we understand the enemy that we face?
Well, I suspect that at some level, a lot of Americans do. In the polls I've been seeing, they realize that the people we're dealing with over there are not people you can negotiate with. They're even much more skeptical than the non-skepticism of the administration in terms of negotiating with Iran. They declare they're skeptical, but it doesn't seem as if they are. And Americans, as a whole, I think, understand that we have a problem right now. We have a president who won't even name it. Prime Minister Netanyahu named radical Islam last week, and he did so confident that moderate Muslims, who are obviously the vast majority, are not going to be any more offended by that than moderate Christians are when Christian terrorists are called terrorists, or moderate Jews are when Jewish terrorists are called terrorists, or moderate secularists are when secularist terrorists are called terrorists. You could say that part of the definition of a moderate is that they're not offended when the radicals who act in the name of the same religion are identified as such.
Jonathan Wolstetter with us as we continue on. We haven't really talked about our friends, or at one time our friends, the Russians.
Well, look, we have a reset policy that has been a disaster. We have reset ourselves into a situation where Putin is contemplating possibly invading one or more Baltic countries to seize Russian-speaking provinces. because we have done nothing in Ukraine, although we have an obligation. They're not a member of NATO. So we need to treat an attack on Ukraine as an attack on the United States, as we're legally obligated to under Article 5 of the 1949 NATO Treaty. But we did sign in 1994, the Clinton administration signed as co-guarantor along with the United Kingdom and with Russia, we guaranteed the territorial integrity of Ukraine, in return for which Ukraine surrendered 5,000 nuclear warheads and all associated systems. And that was the third largest arsenal on the planet after the United States and Russia. They surrendered that with this guarantee, which we have dishonored. Now, we're not obligated to treat it as an attack on American territory, but sending meals ready to eat and blankets is not going to help them in a war where in the first year, it's been almost exactly a year since Vladimir Putin invaded Crimea. And in that year, the latest tally I've seen is 6,000 dead. And the last tally I saw at the 11th-month mark was 11,000 wounded. We have more than seven times Ukraine's population. So if you would say multiply by seven what it would mean for us, we're talking 42,000 dead in a year and 77,000 wounded in 11 months. You know, with the if you were to extrapolate, the casualties probably went up again by another 5,000 equivalent. You know, it would have been over 80,000 American wounded. Think that that's a war. And we could send them all sorts of equipment, teach them how to use it. There's all sorts of sophisticated ground systems. And we could provide them with aerial intelligence. And we're not doing it. And the only way to get the Russians out of there is the way they were pushed out of Afghanistan, which was that the body bags start coming home and people start saying, hey, we didn't sign on for this. And if Putin saw body bags coming home in any profusion, his position would be endangered. And he would have to respond by pulling back. The Ukrainians are willing to fight. Nobody's asking us to send the 82nd or the 101st Airborne,
right?
Least of all the Ukrainians. They want to defend their country. The Israelis are looking at this and saying, well, what happens if we're attacked? In the last time around, although we did help in the Hamas-Gaza war, we also cut off supplies late in that war, routine resupply to force the Israelis to curtail their operations. So we were not 100% behind them, although the prime minister was very gracious last week and tactically wise in not reminding his congressional audience of that.
Jonathan Wohlstetter, we appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Well, always a pleasure to be with you, Kevin, and your audience, and I'll have more on these issues going forward on Letter from the Capitol, which is my one-stop shop for my Twitter page, books, and articles, etc. Thanks to your audience for tuning in, and thanks again, as always, for having me.
Thank you, sir.
All right, take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Kevin Miller in the morning. Let's take a look at traffic now.
Sean Hannity, weekdays at 3. Now, back to Kevin Miller on 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
Well, we really enjoyed that conversation with Jonathan Wohlstetter. And by the way, you can always get him at Letter from the Capitol, capital with an O, .com. And we do appreciate that. If you missed any portion of the interview, you can always go to 580KIDO.com. Kevin Miller with you in the morning here at 580KIDO. And, you know, this was a while ago, this clip from Hillary Clinton where she says, you know, aren't we ready for a woman president? And when we elected President Obama, what was the promise? The promise was that President Obama would bring the races closer together. Now, you tell me, have the races become closer? My favorite thing, what was it, almost a month ago, where they started comparing Ferguson to Selma. Now, in Selma, Alabama, you had people that were being beaten. Their rights were denied again and again and again. And they stood up, white, black, and marched for freedom. In fact, they called them the Freedom Riders. People would bus in from all parts of the South to make a difference in a nonviolent way, led by Dr. King. Today, we have the Reverend Al Sharpton. We have the Reverend Jesse Jackson. And when they're not commenting on what's bad with America, they're commenting on what's bad with America. But the point I'm trying to make is Hillary Clinton, when she says, "Are you ready for a woman president?" What scares me, those of you that are still married to the opposite sex in America today, could we see Hillary Clinton do the same thing when it comes to gender that Barack Obama did for racial relations? I mean, you talk about being in the doghouse. We talk about people not getting along. Racial relations in this country will take years to recover. Could you imagine if she does half of what Barack did for race, if she does that for gender relations? Well, we'll all be subscribing to Cosmopolitan.